Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by my place, Wellington Square Bookshop. Look us up. You know, I used to say on all these different social media, but just Google us. And luckily now we kind of come to the top. And as I'm always proud to say, we just won Best Bookstore in Philadelphia and we won Best Coffee Shop. So we're really happy about that. Today, we're really lucky enough to have with us Erica Swiler. Erica graduated NYU, is a writer and playwright. She lives on Long Island. She swam before she walked. She spent her money at carnivals, as I did. She bakes stuff, as I don't. She takes pictures. She has a humor blog, which is great, and a baking blog. And she has a very petulant rabbit. And if I had a nickel for every petulant rabbit I've had, I would have 20 cents. And if you added nasty-ass peacocks, I would have 30 cents. And she seems really sweet and really funny and really nice. She says she can beat anyone at whack-a-mole, but I actually did play last week, and I am pretty good. I played at Hershey Park. So, anyway, her first novel, The Book of Speculation, will be published tomorrow, fortuitously. So perhaps we have scooped that pain in the ass Terry Gross, but I never know. Anyway, so tomorrow, published by St. Martin's Press. The Book of Speculation is a book about a book that takes our protagonist, Simon, on a journey that I don't think he ever thought he would be taking. And along with him, at least for part of the time, is his sister, Enola, unfortunately named after the Enola Gay. In an alternating voice, we go back in time to a carnival world of mystery, fascination, and fortune, where Amos and Evangeline join us there, and they foretell events that happen a century later. And there's so many other well-drawn characters as well. Anyway, we all live lives where choices are made every day, choices that alter the course of our lives, whether we like it or not. Those lives are affected far more if, and it's a big if, the past comes up as if from the sea to drag us back down based on multiple paths that reverberate, that cling, that bind us, for good or for bad. Then the ultimate question is, what do we do with that? Do we screw our courage to the sticking post, or do we run away and live a life of regret and what might have been or what must now be? So, okay, enough of that. Enough of me telling what the book is about. Hi, Erica. How are you?
Hi. Wow, you made it sound so good. I want to read it.
I'll send you a copy, but it's not out yet. Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
And the cool thing is, the book's coming out. It's our book club pick for September, and then we have 2 days. It meets Wednesday and then Thursday night, and then the next night you're coming to see us too, which is so cool.
I know, I'm so excited.
It'll be great. We'll have a good time. So anyway, now that I've tortured your plot with my explanation, why don't you tell us a little bit about what your book is about?
Let's see. The way I explain it very, very briefly is to say that it is about a librarian versus his house versus the sea versus his sister versus a curse.
That's pretty
so,
good.
Yeah, that's the very simple through line. But it's a dual narrative that basically encompasses a full history of a family over 250 years and a drowning curse that plagues the women who all drown on July 24th.
Does July 24th have any specific meaning for you, or did you just pick it?
For me, that's really the very deep heart of the summer, and that's when all the sorts of interesting things that you find happening on beaches are happening. Like, it's full-on jellyfish season, and horseshoe crabs are out, and it's a really active time for people to be in the water, so anything that's going to happen on the shoreline is going to happen around then. It's also pretty big into storm season for most areas, so it's ripe for plot.
Yeah, storms figure prominently in this, and also horseshoe crabs are almost like another character in the book.
Yeah, I'm really, really in love with them. I think they're just absolutely fascinating creatures, and I hope no one gets mad at me for how I portrayed them, because I just think they're so beautiful, and they've been around for eons, just absolute, since almost the beginning of history on this planet. So I sort of look at them as these almost otherworldly beings that probably know more about what's going on the planet than people do.
I know. I'm always interested in creatures that have not changed in like 300 million years, like cockroaches. Like they, you know, it's like, we're cool, we're fine. You want to have your nuclear wars, global warming. We're still going to be here. You're going to be gone.
Right. It's also really rare to find something that's, as far as, you know, evolution, they were perfect. They didn't have to change. And that's amazing.
Yeah, they just worked out. Yeah, and it is funny how you say you apologize to readers who feel differently about those crabs because, like, when they're, without giving things away, when they interact with Simon the way they do, at first you think, oh, this is kind of, I don't know, what a repellent.
Cool, creepy.
Yeah. But then you know, and you do that really well because it contains all these elements of, you know, well, maybe this is a nice way to whatever. And, so I will try to not spoil. Anyway, so you're really fascinated with books. The cover, which is beautiful, is a bunch of books. You're not the person on the cover, are you?
No. I like to pretend that I am, but I'm not.
It's a great cover. And
thank you.
You're fascinated with libraries, bindings. In fact, you know, why don't you tell the story about how you submitted this book?
Oh, okay. This is not something I would recommend anybody else try. It's a total act of madness. But I submitted 16 hand-bound copies of the manuscript. Or actually, I made 16. I think 14 were submitted. I had two that I kept for myself. So what I did was I printed out the whole book, hand-bound it with this paper that I found that looked very, very much like leather. I stained all the edges with tea and coffee and aged them down with rasps. I put in tea-stained illustrations and aged a bunch of tarot cards so that people would be able to flip through this book and encounter the same sort of elements that my protagonist, Simon, does when he finds this mysterious old book. So it became this really interactive experience, but it also became this incredible mad art project that took over my entire apartment at the time for the better part of a summer. So yeah, I taught myself how to bind books, gild them, stain them, age paper, the whole nine yards. It was pretty intense. I would say most of my friends thought I was a little bit insane, but in the end, I came out with this wonderful, you know, art object that I thought, well, if no one picks this up, at least I have this for myself, and I know that I put everything I possibly could into it. And it worked.
I like the idea that you kept two of them for yourself.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you need some record that you did this sort of thing, you know. So
it is cool.
I have it, and it's my book, baby.
Yeah. And the illustrations, too. Would you normally, when you write again, will you do that? Your new book about space, time, and everything?
I don't know how that's going to work yet with the new book, but this one, it felt sort of organic, just as a way to engage with the book. As I was trying to, you know, make my grand pitch to publishers, I thought, well, if they can see the book, that would be helpful. And they said, oh, yes, well, St. Martin's, we'll buy your illustrations. And I was kind of floored by that because I don't really consider myself an illustrator. But, so it was just a nice opportunity to really have another dialogue with the reader. And then the more I thought about it, the more entwined the idea of illustration became with the book until I don't know how I didn't think to illustrate it right from the get-go.
It's funny, like, when I first opened my bookstore, it was just a rare bookstore, then I expanded it. But I have a first edition, first printing of James Joyce's Ulysses with the blue wrapper still in and all that. And so
oh, book envy.
I have a lot of really nice rare books. Anyway, so then I started the bookstore and I said, well, now I have to sell my books. But it was horrible. And so someone bought the James Joyce for like $20,000+. And I sent it to him. He was in Scotland. And not Ireland, he was in Scotland. And like after I sold it to him, I said, oh, I can't. So I called I called him back and I bought it back from him for $2,000 more than I sold it. Which I realized, you know, this is like about as horrible a businessman as you can possibly be.
But there are some things you can't part with because it's just for the object itself and for the history that you build with it. You know, like it becomes your book.
So. I know, but you don't make any money that way.
You don't make a lot of money that way.
You lose money. But in the meantime, he did have it bound by the Chelsea bindery, so it was beautiful.
Oh.
So it was, what's his name? The Harrington boys. But yeah, so that was really nice.
Oh, wow. Now so, I have serious Mackenzie.
Did you pick the cover, or was it? Did you vet the cover, or?
There was a lot of discussion over the cover. We went through a whole bunch of iterations. We went through some very literal interpretations with the house on the cliff. I think in some of the international editions, you start to see the house on the cliff appear more. But I think we really thought the idea of having the books on the cover themselves would really connect with the reader, particularly because it is a book that so heavily involves books and people in the various book trades. So it just, it connected with people that way.
Well, but yeah, and plus, you know, the librarian aspect of it.
Yeah.
And you talk so much about how you love librarians.
Oh, I do. I love libraries, librarians, the whole, yeah, they're just wonderful.
It's funny, you know. Well, so that's the cover. I was expecting when I turned the pages after you dedicated, I expected to see an epigraph. And then I thought, well, I wonder if she thought about writing an epigraph. So then I started thinking about what would be a good epigraph. And then I came across this quote by Edmund Wilson that said, no two persons ever read the same book.
Oh.
And I thought, yeah, that'd be good.
That would be pretty perfect.
Why is it really a book of speculation? I mean, there's parts of... Yeah, why is it speculation?
Well, it is partially because people do find different things when they read books. This one in particular, I think, because it sort of... it crosses some different genres. I've seen that people have trouble classifying exactly what it is, that it's been called mystery, fantasy, sci-fi, magical realism, the whole nine yards, and
right.
literary fiction at the same time. So it's quite literally saying that people are having different readings of it, different ideas about it, and we do really find different things in books. And I think for Simon in particular, he's looking through this book and trying to figure out where he came from, what his family was like, and what actually happened to him. And that is all speculation, because it's just, he's piecing things together from scant words here and there and trying to build a world around it. And in some ways, that's what we do when we read, and very much that's what we do when we write.
And you know what? What's better than not being classified? You know, I mean, you don't
write.
You don't want to be classified in life or in your art or whatever it is.
I think that I very much agree with that. And I've always wondered about the genre divide, so to speak. I think they're wonderful for classifying where you want to put something on a shelf, but they're terrible for helping readers find books that they like.
I know.
So,
and owning a bookstore, it's like, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like you say you can't judge a book by its cover, but every single person comes in and judges the books by their covers. And that's why publishers pick the covers.
Right.
Because they want to sell books.
They want to sell books, and they want to appeal towards a certain type of reader. But I think in some ways, readers are much smarter than, you know, classifications. So I like the idea that this is sort of bouncing around between different genres, so to speak, and finding different homes.
Well, what's cool is that having this show, like I interviewed the women who wrote, one wrote 800 Grapes and one wrote I'm Having So Much Fun Here Without You. And they're both like, you know, the word, they're both like chick lit, and they're both like pick.
Right.
It's all beach reads.
Oh, that word.
Chick lit, beach read, summer, you know, all that. And
right.
So I wouldn't read them. I'm a guy. I wouldn't pick them up and read them.
But right. And that's terrible. I feel terribly for people who don't pick up stuff like that.
I know, but you guys don't do it. No, guys aren't in book clubs. I mean, it's just a weird thing.
And that's such a shame. They should be.
But
that's how you meet great women. Book
yeah.
clubs. That's how you meet great men. Just book clubs.
I know. And being in the back row at yoga.
Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh.
Well,
you won't find me there.
But it's like, so then I wouldn't have read them. But then after I read them, I realize, you know, there's more here.
Oh, there's so much there. Right.
And it's like, you know, maybe that 800 Grapes book was a little bit like Falcon Crest or something like that. But also, there was so much more there that I would never have had a chance to talk about or to read.
Right. And I feel that in some ways, trying to put something into a genre and calling it chick lit or whatever is denying the fact that it can have a complex idea that appeals to more than one person or to more than just a small target demo. And that's sad to think that people are missing out on a more complex level of thought simply because something isn't the right color for them. They won't pick it up because it's pink or because it says chick on it. Ugh, that's terrible. That's a shame.
Yeah, I know. It's, you know, if you see a picture of a girl who's the top of her head is cut off, which they do for young adults, it's always
right.
A pretty girl. Top of her head is cut off so parents don't think it's too explicit.
Right.
And they're all over the store, and it's just funny how it's almost like an algorithm that the publisher has, but it has nothing to do with literature or writing.
Right. It has less to do with the content of the book and more to do with how they think they can, you know, stimulate some sales to keep this author alive, essentially. So I'm for it, and at the same time, not so much.
Right. You know, it's the lesser of two evils, because
yeah.
In order to get published, that has
right.
to happen.
You have to be able to continue having a career. So it's understandable, and yet at the same time, such a shame.
So who do you think my two favorite characters in the book are?
Oh, let's see. Everybody that I know loves Doyle.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's one.
Okay. And, I go with Peabody, because why not?
Peabody I love, but...
Okay. Excellent.
But if I had to pick someone that I would want to spend the rest of my life with, it would be Alice.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, Alice is kind of great. I do love her.
She's like right out of My Girl Friday or one of those old the movies with Cary Grant and whoever.
She's very straightforward. I like that a lot about her.
And she's sarcastic, and she's also, she's very tolerant, and she's the kind of woman that you very seldom meet that just says, okay, I got to go. But she doesn't say it in a mean way. She never says anything in a mean way.
Yeah, I think she's very careful about being kind, but is very happy to let you know when she's had enough and she's done. And would that more people could be like that.
Yeah, and she'll say something like, you know, I need some time.
Yeah, yeah.
And people don't, I was talking to someone about that, about processing things. And people like me who are impulsive and neurotic, you know, I want an answer right away.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean they have to give me one.
you know,
they don't have to. They can take their time and work their way through it. And,
well, also, with Alice, I really wanted to have a character who clearly had a life going on outside of the text. Like, as things are falling apart for Simon and Enola and everybody in the present day, Alice has her own story happening, with her library is also falling apart. Her family is falling apart. So there are things going off screen, so to speak, for Alice. And her needing to take time and saying that has to be, you know, it had to be clear. And you had to have this idea that there is a larger world outside of, you know, Simon and his insular problems. So that was important for me with her.
Yeah, but what was interesting and the way you did it was really cool was, you know, she's brought right into the middle of it because of her father. And, you know, without giving anything away, it's just another element that the reader doesn't expect. You don't expect that. You don't expect it in a couple of ways.
Right.
And so then at the end, she's drawn into this part of this strange life, that this is what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wanted that to feel also very much like her own decision. Like she would, what she does in the end is also very much for her and not just about Simon and his world blowing up. So I had to have reasons for her to be there. And that felt, you know, she had to be a strong character for that. So.
Yeah, and the other thing that's cool is that rather than tying this book up at the end with a knot and saying, here it is, it's done, we'll just hand you this package, you don't. At first, I thought maybe you would.
Right.
But you don't. And even like the very end, okay, what exactly is going to, you know, like when I was talking about screwing your courage to the sticking post.
Yeah.
I don't know. And that's
right.
What,
well, I know.
You do?
I probably went through about 80 different iterations of the end. And so, I mean, I know what happens after, and there is an after. So for me, it's nice and neatly tied up. But that doesn't, for this book, I don't think that works. That would work so well for a reader. And it's sort of, because there is so much linking and overlapping between the history and the present day, that to tie it up too neatly, I think, would just, I don't know, somehow make the story a little too cute, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does, because the reason why book club people claw at each other is because of this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, they'll say,
it's nice to have discussion, and it's nice that, you know, a reader can participate and make their own ending that's either, you know, terribly bleak or completely happy or whatever they like.
Yeah, I know. On one side of it, the modern side, people are going to go, oh, Simon is so, why can't he be more whatever?
And other people, yeah.
And other people are going to go, no, I like the way he chases all these things down. But
well, yeah, I like the idea of him being quite prickly in the sense that he's not, like, you can have great sympathy for him, but he's not necessarily immediately likable.
No.
And that's important to me because I think very few people are immediately likable in a way that's, you know, in a way that you trust it. So...
Yeah.
For me, yeah.
Well, plus, you know, the transitions you do, too, because, you know, the first page of Doyle, it's like, you know, get the hell out of here, you know?
Right.
And then you end up like everybody, like, you know, he just...
Right, right. He's an interesting shift because, I mean, there are so many people that, especially I think when, you know, partners come into a family, like boyfriends, girlfriends, stepfathers, stepmothers, things like that, you get to, there's this immediate gut reaction of, get away, you're not wanted here. You're not part of the unit. And to be able to break through that and to become this very likable person is, you know, it's a challenge, and I think it's a really common narrative for a lot of people. So it felt nice to be able to do that with Doyle, to just have someone who's, you know, an interesting guy, possibly a bad dude, but maybe not, who knows, yeah.
And not only interesting and likable, but he's also... insightful and intelligent in an interesting way.
Yeah, yeah. I think because he's very calm. He's a really, really calm presence. And I think everybody else in, well, Simon and Enola are sort of functioning at level 11 as far as their nerves and what's happening in their timeline. So it's always nice to have a very calm, soothing presence who just wants them to, just to counteract that sort of nervous energy.
And it's funny, too, because when you go back, and you know, sometimes I look at books with alternating chapters and I think, oh, I don't know if I want to, you know. And
yeah.
But then, because I think, you know, I'm going to want to skip them because I like
right.
them. But this works out really well because, you know, there's a connection, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But also because each side is very interesting and you can see the plot movement in each one as you go through each chapter. And then also, like with Evangeline... and Amos, it's, I can't explain it. There's kind of a softness when you go into the past and your book.
Right, right.
It's blurred.
I would say it's more romantic if I had to put a word on it, but it's not quite because it's also slightly sinister.
Slightly, yeah. Well, you know, talking about wooden spoons, yeah, it's slightly
yeah,
sinister.
Yeah, I do mean things to my characters, but that's fiction.
It's funny because... all my life, I've loved swimming underwater for a long time. In fact, I don't like swimming except if I swim underwater.
Right, right. It's just that escape from the above and being in a completely different world that's so close to back where you're from, yeah.
Yeah, and I start out the summer like I am now in my pool, being able, it's 20 by 40, so I can do two or three lengths, and by the end of the summer, I can do five or six. So that's, you know, 250-some feet, which is good.
Mm, yeah.
And, and also the last feeling, the feeling of panic, you know, and
yeah.
And thinking about it, thinking, what is this panic? What is this going on in my head? Why am I know mm-hmm. I can still live. Why am I so scared, you know?
Right, right. Yeah. I think for me, just the being underwater, it is such a foreign alien world, but it's also, it's very comforting because there are very few times, I can't think of any other way that you can ever feel the same even amount of pressure over your entire body. It's the closest thing to, you know, just a full, complete body hug. And at the same time, it's completely dangerous and can kill you.
Right.
So it's this very interesting dichotomy for me of complete comfort and yet also danger. So I like playing with that idea a lot.
And also, you know, I mean, you know, everyone says their book is kind of autobiographical, but not. But, you know, pretty much everything actually
yes.
has to be autobiographical because it comes out of your head.
But, right, right.
But, like, if you say you learned to swim before you learned to walk, I mean, water obviously plays a large part.
Water is a huge yeah. part of my life. Totally. And, I mean, I did grow up on the shore, and I think that was a real gift for me, and part of why I wanted to write about this is, you know, this area, is because it is so fragile. And a lot of it is vanishing just because of climate change, erosion, and eventually sea level rise. Like, parts of Long Island wash out every year. And so it's this very, very unique place, and it's going pretty quickly. And so it felt, in a lot of ways, very important to write about it, to share it with people, and to just let people see the gift that this area is. Plus, people also have some very negative ideas about Long Island, and they just don't realize what, how much of it is these unique little places and how special it is.
Yeah, it's like we were talking about earlier before we started the show about, you know, East Hampton, and that's what people
right.
think of, or they think of Bayshore
right,
or Babylon.
Right. They either think of, you know, like a New York City Junior or the Hamptons, and there is an entire island in between, which is totally different, and it has a lot of these little sort of fishingy type towns and just these beach communities and places where people have lived since the 1600s and 1700s, and you just don't think about it. You think of all these flashy things you see on TV.
I know, that's whenever we were talking about the drive, and it is a Long Island. I always think I would like to spend a couple of weeks just pulling off everywhere, you know,
mm-hmm.
and just looking at each place. I haven't done it. And then, you know, the light's different there, too.
Oh, it is. Anywhere there's this much water, you just get this really interesting, glowy sort of filmy light that's just, it's beautiful.
Have you ever been underwater, like when Simon, not necessarily Enola, but when Simon is underwater, where you kind of hear this presence, not someone calling your name necessarily.
Right, but just, I mean...
Because it's primordial, that's where we came
it
from.
It is. Well, it's also any sort of sound you hear underwater just has this deep echoing feeling to it. And yes, you get it in your ears, but you also feel sound through your entire body just because of the nature that you're surrounded by this liquid. And so, yeah, I mean, if you're underwater and you hear someone going nearby in a rowboat, it hits you in your chest, just the sound of the oars against the boat, just that knocking. It feels like it's knocking inside you. And so that, to me, is just the way you experience sound and light underwater is just incredible.
How did you, switching to another one of your interests, how did you... Like I talked about the same thing about carnivals. What was it
right.
that when you were young, you know, made, and my kids are the same way, just drives you to the carnival and you just want to be there. And
right. You just have to be there. There's just stuff going on.
Yeah. And like you said, it's not, it's all cool, but some of it's sleazy. And the sleaziness
right.
is like Times Square used to be, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's weird because it's that sleaziness I actually find really attractive.
Me too. And that's where Doyle comes in.
Right, right. And, I mean, it's very strange because, you know, as a perfectly scrubbed, clean-cut little kid, that's just something that you're not exposed to except when the carnival comes in town. And these people seem dangerous and very exciting. But at the same time, they're just actual real people like anyone else. And they just make their living differently. And so that getting to experience that sort of, I don't know, transient sort of lifestyle was always fascinating to me. And I think that sort of triggered me into wanting to explore performance and stuff like that and to just figure out what that kind of world was about.
Yeah. It's funny. What about clowns? Because you talk about clowns a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I guess in college, I had a professor who was actually a ringmaster in a circus. So she was my voice teacher, and she did whiteface clowning, which was really interesting. And that's when I realized, wow, people actually, you know, people I know who I have respectable day jobs also do this. Like, running away with the circus is an option. And, yeah, I guess my studio also offered a course in clowning, and I was like, yes, I'm doing this. I have to see what it's about, mostly because I was terrified. It's just pure improvisation, and it's, you know, for someone who lives as much in their head as I do, that's the most terrifying thing you can ask someone. And I was terrible. I was the worst clown ever. I tell people I have never cried more than I did in clown class. I just was painfully unfunny until, you know, I would be funny accidentally. And then I try and dissect it and figure out why I was funny, which, of course, is the last thing you should do. But it was a full semester exercise in torture. But it gave me the utmost respect for people who just pursue that as their living and career. That's the bravest thing I can think of as far as, you know, just putting yourself out there.
My brother is terrified of clowns.
And, oh, yeah.
You know, it's like a
stereotype. Very, very common.
Yeah, I know. It's because there's this exterior that's... it's all this laughter and happiness, mm-hmm. and then inside you're scared because
right.
you don't
right.
know.
It's very frightening for a lot of people to see people exhibiting extreme emotion. And clowning is so, so much about extreme emotion. Like, they essentially, when you go through training, they try and take you back to about when you're four, and you just react to everything as just a shout, you know, a shout of joy, of sadness, of happy, you know, just it's all on go all the time. And it's exhausting to do, and it can be really terrifying for people who are used to things being, you know, restrained and a very calm every day. So it's interesting that way, and very off-putting for a lot of people, but also very freeing for people, too.
Yeah, it's funny because, and I think writers are able to access this part of their life, is that pretty much everyone stays 4 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they don't really change. They can talk about mutual funds and golf and stuff like that, but
right,
they don't really change. They're the same person they were.
Right.
And to be able to access that, especially if it was something you enjoyed or if it was full of love or whatever, it's a wonderful thing. And it gives you, you know, it's like you'll meet maybe like six people in your life who are totally integrated in the sense that they just are who they are,
right,
you know?
Right.
And you know them when you see them. But
yeah.
I'm not one. But you see people that all they are is just what they are.
Right. And that is very much at the heart of clowning and that sort of, and performance, essentially. It's just being in that exact moment, feeling everything, you know, at level 11 and being okay with it and being very, very vulnerable. And, you know, that's difficult and frightening.
It is. It's like meditation or the Shambhala kind of meditation where your heart is essentially outside of your body and there it is and anyone can do whatever they want to it. You're totally vulnerable. And it's really scary, but it's also a complete letting go.
Right.
And so it's very freeing at the same time.
Yeah. Oh, it's like putting a book out.
here's my other story. So my grandfather, who was also named Samuel Hankin, he was from Vitebsk in Belarus, which was the Pale of Settlement for Jewish people. Uh-huh. And so he was born in like the 1890s. Mm-hmm. But his contemporary was Marc Chagall, who lived in the same town. And then Marc Chagall's painting, which was always my favorite painting before I even knew about this, was Me and My Village. And that street is where my grandfather lived.
Oh, wow.
And with your upcoming novel, Space and Time and the Idea of Everything, Emmanuel Velikovsky lived there, too. And he's the guy who wrote Worlds in Collision, which is all about that, too. So there's a kind of, world of speculation, too.
Right. Yeah, well, I think you have these inherited sensibilities that you don't necessarily understand why you like these things that you like or you connect with them. And I think, for me, I think that's sort of this, I don't know, shared inherited past in a way. Like, you liked that painting before you knew.
Yes, I did.
And that's just something about how you were raised and just, you know, your family sensibility that's passing down this history without explicitly telling you what it is. And so I love that idea, that shared past sort of thing, that story that we don't necessarily tell. And that for me was a lot of the heart of this book. And whereas what I'm toying with in the next book is how we kind of experience each second, how you think it's a very short amount of time, but it can be this protracted idea where you feel all sorts of things at once and you can live a lifetime in a second. So,
yeah. Well, time is, you know, it's hard. It's got to be hard to write about it because there's so many books and...
Right.
But yes, the idea of dividing, I mean, because, you know, obviously we created time and because without it we couldn't be here. Everything would be frozen.
Right.
But, yeah, it's like you said about me knowing. I did know. And then I don't really believe in that stuff, so it's really hard to accept it.
Right. But I think you always have to think about things as you were probably informed very subtly, just from stories from your parents with stories from your grandparents, and that slowly sort of develops your taste without realizing it. So you were getting a cultural history that would prime you for liking a painting like that without necessarily knowing, like, this is so deeply related to who I am. So.
And it's funny, my brothers could care less about all this, but I'm like Simon, you know, I go to Ancestry.
You have to know.
Yeah, I go to Ancestry.com. I get all the medical records from my grandfather to see what happened and why he died and how he died and all that. And then I just keep scrounging and going and going and going until I'm blocked like Simon was.
Right, right. There's always a wall somewhere. And,
yeah.
You know, for a lot of people, most people, it's either, you know, things... Ellis Island is difficult for a lot of people because a lot of names changed. For other people, it's the depression because you just lost relatives due to, you know, poverty and people scattering. So hit things like that. I guess, with my family, I think on my mom's side, I'm sure I have relatives all over the place. But, because of the depression, we lost track of people. So
yeah,
interesting, like, you hit walls.
Like in Vitebsk, it was destroyed during the pogroms, which is why my grandfather
right.
left. Then it was destroyed in World War I. Then it was destroyed in World War II. So there's not much I can go back to.
Yeah.
But I would like to, and I should. I just never have done it. But, yeah, it's there's something that calls you back. And that's like the ocean, too. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you have a line in your book about that, too, about being called back. There's someone... somewhere that is like being called back to the water.
It does. The water does have a pull. It really does, especially if you've grown up by it. You just, you know, if you get too far from it, you start to miss it. And it really does add a rhythm to your day. You know, if you're on a shore, you start to wonder, like, when the tide is up, when the tide is down. You can tell by the smell in the air. You know, it becomes just this presence in your life that's always subtle and lurking, and it's very comforting because, I mean, sometimes I don't have to look at a clock. I can wander around and just go, you know, smell the air and know that it's low tide or it's high tide and things like that. And it becomes this part of you.
Yeah, it's like the way Simon can just walk out, you know, he can walk out at low tide and just walk out.
Yeah.
So you left Long Island, but you were drawn back to it, right?
Yeah, I did. I was out of Long Island I lived in Florida for a short period of time, and then I was in school in Manhattan, and I lived in Brooklyn like every other novelist for about 10 years. So. But I think it was very important to leave just because it lets you write about where you come from with a little more perspective. It lets you love it a little more because you miss it, and also look at things with clearer eyes as far as its problems as well.
I think the way it works is that if you move around and someone says, where are you from? And you say Long Island, you know, where's home? And you think in your mind, that's my home.
Yeah.
Then I think that's how you decide.
Yeah, I think so too. And it is a complicated narrative saying that you're from Long Island because most people don't quite get what it is or they have that strange image of it. You know, most people from Long Island wind up saying, oh, I'm from New York, and leaving it at that, and everyone assumes it's, you know, the city. But, yeah. But it's different.
Yeah, I know, because there's so many stereotypical places from Fire Island. Everyone has their exact idea of what that's like, you know.
Right, and they have their exact idea of the accent, too, which...
Oh, yeah. Yes.
I don't think I have one, but I might be wrong.
No, you have the new accent, which is not, I don't mean in a bad way, the accent.
No.
Yeah, the no accent kind of accent.
Good. But very,
do I have an accent?
Well, not that I know. I didn't notice it, but no, that's the funny thing. When they were doing the audiobooks, I got to hear, I guess for the UK release, they sent me samples of people who were being auditioned to read, and you know, I kept wondering, oh, no, what if they do a Long Island accent? This is going to be terrible. But they wound up just going with standard no-accent American. And I said, good, perfect.
Yeah, it's well, yeah, obviously, the reader makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. You know, there's this book I just read called What Do We See When We Read?
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about how, like, if you're reading The Fall of the House of Usher, you kind of know that there's this mansion and it's falling, but what do you see?
Right.
Do you see
what
it?
What do you actually see? Yeah.
Or if you're reading Anna Karenina or something, do you see her? Do you see the full skirt? Do you see her dancing?
Mm-hmm.
What do you see? So, like, when you see Alice, what do I see? What do I see when I see Doyle? I have a good picture of Doyle, but it's very, and especially like if this got picked up or probably will get picked up, optioned or something like that.
One hopes.
Do you know what they look like?
Oh, I mean, I know what they look like to me, but I think I want to be very open and let let readers and you know, I guess hopefully casting people put their idea on it. Because, I mean, ultimately, at this point, I've given them away. You know, they're mine when I'm working on it, and they're mine when I read to myself. But once it's out in the world, they're other people's. And, like, Doyle is very specific to me because, you know, there are people that I've taken his different traits from. So I know, you know, I know how his voice sounds in my head and what he looks like specifically. And, you know, I have a very specific image for Simon that doesn't necessarily fit anyone else's. So, and Amos, I intentionally wrote with some ambiguity because I felt it really necessary that people be able to identify with him in a very sympathetic manner. So, you know, I think there's a lot of room for play in appearances in there, except that Alice really should have red hair.
Yeah, and Alice is beautiful to me. Mm-hmm. Simon is not, because you said breakfast face.
Right.
So that immediately...
Well, no one looks good in the morning. No one, I mean, anyone looks their absolute worst over breakfast. So
unless you're in love with them. And that's...
Well, right. If you're in love with them, that's fine. But...
So that's what I was trying to contemplate with regard to Alice's feelings towards him when she said that. And she's so adamant about things, but so nice about him at the same time, like I was talking about. And then Evangeline has got to be beautiful. And then when she comes out of the tank and she's in that diaphanous thing, she's got to be beautiful too.
Right, right. She has to be very, very striking at the least. So, yeah. I mean, I suppose there are actresses I could think of doing that, but I'd rather just wait and see if what people think she looks like. So.
Yeah,
and it would be interesting, I guess, somebody had mentioned at some point, oh, what if the same person played them? I said, oh, that would be wonderful and great for that actress.
Well, it's funny because I guess, like, with regard to Amos, I think of the guy in Brave New World who grew up on his own and then was, you know, put into society. That's who I think of, is that kind of look. Not a feral look, but, you know, he's there by himself without... And also, well, I can say he's... The fact that he can't, you know, he can't speak. So,
he can't speak.
But there's part of me that feels like, yeah, he could. He could.
Right. Well, I mean, there was, I guess in the initial writing process, I had wondered if he was physically unable to speak or if it was simply a matter of, you know, the wild child syndrome where you don't get to develop language because no one has spoken to you. And I decided, for me, I read it as he is physically unable to speak. However, it's totally okay with me if other people read it as he cannot speak just because he was not spoken to. Like, both ways work for me, so.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, part of me was thinking in this romantic sense that one day, you know, something would happen.
Right, that one day he might, but, yeah. I don't know, I really liked the idea of having someone who was forced to really make their own language and determined to speak so that this gift would be taken quite seriously for him, because language is such a huge, huge part of that narrative, and just miscommunications. And people who have language and are perfectly capable of speaking still miscommunicate. So I thought it would be interesting to explore somebody who has to really, really think about how to say what they want to say and to make it direct, but all they had to work with was symbols.
Well, that actually is a perfect lead into the fact that not only is the book about a book, but it's also, you know, imbued, informed, which is not a word I like, but with the tarot cards. And how does that come into your life, and why did it arise in your mind as a method of which, you know, with regard to everybody, and Nola and Amos and everybody.
Well, I'm really lucky in that tarot feels so natural to a carnival world. You know, while it's interesting because it's not necessarily, you know, a main stage sort of act, like, it's always there out on the edges. And you're never surprised if somebody who, you know, works in a carnival, whatever, oh, I read tarot cards on the side. Of course you do. Why wouldn't you? But it's something, I guess, like every girl at some point, I became really, really fascinated with tarot in college. And I was reading all about cards and things like that, and was doing readings for myself and readings for friends. And when I thought up this world and I had this mute person, I thought, well, this is just the perfect tool for symbolic language, because you have these archetypes put out in pictures, and people automatically ascribe meaning to them, different layered things. And but they're so open to interpretation that it is, in some ways, very much a spoken language. It has its own tone, depending on who's reading it or who's listening to the readings. So it felt really, really natural that way. And then as I was going through, I kind of built my own language with the cards. So the side effect being I can't really read Tarot for myself anymore because I feel so connected to it as this language and as reading sort of what you want that, I can't actually do traditional reading so much anymore.
One of the fascinating things about the book is, you know, you really can't escape the cards, you know?
Right, like, right.
And the idea of like Ryskova and, you know, flipping them so fast that they're dancing.
Right.
And
right.
then, but no matter what she did, it just comes out the same way. You could do it 1,000
right.
times. And that's so scary.
Well, it's also, for me, it's not that scary in the sense that it's a fight. It's a full on fight. They're having a fight in language like you would have with anybody else, with, you know, your friend or a sibling. You're just having a fight, and neither of you refuses to budge on your opinion.
True.
And the tools they have as their words are the cards.
But it's your life, too.
Yeah.
I mean, the cards...
Yeah.
It's fun. Here's another one of my stories, which I overdo. But, I went to this party, and they have, like, a fortune teller there, you know?
Right.
At the party. Sometimes they do that. Now they do a photo booth. But
yeah. They do. Why did that happen?
Or a candy bar thing or whatever.
Right.
So they had this fortune teller, and everyone was in line. She got to me, and she looked at me, and she goes, No. And I thought, okay, that was kind of weird. But then I went again at another party, and there was a different one there, and she did the same thing, and then I got really scared.
Oh, don't. It's sort of people do a quick reading on you in the sense whether they think you'll be receptive to it or if you'll take it too seriously. And if they think you'll be really affected by something, they don't want to do it just because it's not easy on them, you know. If everyone has a good sense of fun and open-mindedness and stuff like that, it's one way. But if people start to take it incredibly seriously as this is your fate and it cannot be changed, that's not good for the person reading cards, and it's not good for the person who's having their cards read.
Maybe that's true. I never really thought about it that way, actually. I always thought that...
It's safety for the person who's doing the reading, and it's safety for you who would be getting the reading. Don't worry about it.
But I don't seem like I'm the kind of person that would... go in there with this mindset.
Oh, but it's one of those things, like, and it is to a certain degree, you know, it's chance and probability. Say the death card pops up, regardless of what it means in the position of the reading,
right.
If it just means, like, oh, forget it, you're getting rid of that card, it's dead, it's still visually shocking, and it affects you. So it's that sort of thing. People do a quick reading as to whether or not they think, you know, you're okay to have your cards read.
It's funny, you know, now that we've been talking about it so long, I realize that all of the things in the book are things that are your things, you know?
Yeah, very much. It's funny, I was in a writing workshop many years ago, and one of my fellow classmates pulled me aside one day and said, you know, you write really well, but I just wish you would write about yourself. You're so interesting. And at first I was hardly offended, and then I thought about it later, and I just started laughing because I was like, well, you clearly don't know me, because I'm very much writing about myself, and I've disguised it rather well.
Well, yeah, but you know, the other thing is, you know, so it's your first novel. It's going to be doing, I think it'll do very well, and I love
one hopes.
And I love your short stories, too. I read all them.
Thanks.
And, but then, you know, there'll come a point where you... will stop writing about yourself. I mean, you'll stop...
It
that way.
No one ever does.
I guess not.
I don't know. I mean, everything you make up is an aspect of yourself, whether it's something that you act upon or not. It's everything that you make up is actually... It's a thought that you've had, so it's part of you. Every character that you make is drawn in some way from somebody that you know or something that you've heard of. You're always writing about yourself, even when you're fabricating strange things like, you know, people who can stay underwater for 20 minutes. It's just, it's all you. It's just how you move it around and change the shape of the puzzle and make it into something more meaningful. Because you without story has no meaning. So making the story, making the book, and taking these things from your life and making it into something different and more, that's fiction.
It's funny because I have this friend who's a painter, and he paints these things that people go up to and they go, I could have done that. And then he goes, well, why didn't you?
Exactly.
I just finished reading this book of short stories by, I've forgotten her name, I have it in my backpack here. It's called Viral, and it's not out yet. And all the stories are about me.
Right.
And they're all exactly me.
Every single one. And they're all, you know, they're all the writer. Every single one. And I mean, yes, it's the writer's imagination, and things turn slightly left, as I like to say. But it's all an aspect of that person, just their thoughts. So, yeah, I mean, there's, everybody is always writing what they know, even when they're fabricating things wildly. So.
And sometimes they're writing, again, with a great deal of courage, because it's not stuff that, you know, that's why I guess it's kind of psychotherapy in a way. But
in some ways, yeah, but therapy is easier.
Yeah, I imagine it. I guess I imagine it is. I write all the time, but I can do narrative and exposition and dialogue. I just don't, I don't have a story. So I can write a book. It just doesn't have a beginning, middle, or end.
Right. Well, some people do that anyway and do quite well for themselves.
I know. That's what really bugs me.
Frustrating. But yeah, I think finding the plot is probably the hardest thing for anyone.
Oh, were you worried about the fact that, you know, there was that book, Department of Speculation, then Book of Speculation?
Oh, it's funny, because I had the title, like, long before Department of Speculation was out, and I saw that, and, you know, then I saw Department of Speculation pop up, and I went, oh, I wonder if I'll be asked to change it. But by then, it was, you know, so close into the publication deadline, I think, that it was, you know, not an issue. And now, hey, if people buy me by mistake, I benefit.
Yeah. Well, it's like, you know, it's funny how the publishing world works, because now I just say...
They go in cycles, yeah.
Yeah, well, now I just say, Good Gone Girl on an Orphan Train. And that combines these five novels right there.
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah, they do go in cycles, as far as, like, number of words in the title, and the book of has been a huge thing for a bit now, and I think this is probably the last wave of those. So, yeah.
And the other thing is, at least half of the authors I interview now go by their initials.
Yeah, I don't know. I felt like, I've lived with this name so long, why do I want to give it up?
When I say during, I said, can I just call you, you know, Tom or Matt? And he goes, no.
No.
Just call me MK.
No. Good for them if they have a line and they're sticking to it, but to me that would feel incredibly stilted. I'm unapologetically myself.
Yeah.
So, yeah. No, I'm Erica Swiler. Always will be.
Okay. I mean, I could go on, but, you know, I tend to do that. We've talked for 53 minutes and 30 minutes.
Oh, wow.
Seconds.
Oh, my gosh.
But so it's great, because I'll get to see you. I'll get to talk to you more. And we really look forward to your book being in the book club. We really look forward to you coming down here.
Oh,
and,
thank you.
I'm so glad that I got to read the book before it's out, because I can tell people about it and they haven't read it yet.
So. I'm so glad that I got to do this before it's out. I get to be excited and happy and, you know, not have to worry about all the after yet.
Yeah, that's great. And then when you write the book about space-time and stuff, I'll be so excited about that too. So we'll talk again then too.
Okay,
thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much.
That was Erica Swiler talking about her book, The Book of Speculation. It's a book about books. It will be released tomorrow. You're listening to it today. And it'll be released tomorrow. It's a great book. It will be our book club selection in September. I think the 16th, we meet during the day, Wednesday. And then Thursday is the 17th in the evening. And then, I guess, Friday, I think that's right, September 18th. Erica will be at the bookstore signing and reading from her book. And the book clubs don't like reading paperbacks, as I've said before, hardbacks, because they cost $29.95 or something. So this book's $26.99. So what we're going to do, because we normally have to wait till it came out in paperback, is we're going to knock 30% off of the book. So it comes into a more reasonable price range, and you can buy it, read it, and then talk with Erica and get your hardback, first printing probably, signed the next day. And just like when we had Christina Baker Klein, it was really nice having all you guys out there, and hopefully that'll happen again. And also with some of the other authors, because we have, unless we switch things around, so I'm not going to say the dates, I'll just tell you who we have coming up. We have Cy Montgomery. She wrote Soul of an Octopus, which is a really good book about how it's not octopi, it's octopuses, so she says, about how octopuses really are sentient and have their own sense of self-awareness. And then Matthew Thomas, who's good friends with Christina Baker Klein, he wrote this book called We Are Not Ourselves, which was really good. Courtney Maugham, we talked about her today. She wrote that book, I'm Having So Much Fun Here Without You, which was really good. Emily Mitchell, who wrote this book of short stories, which isn't out yet, Viral. Best short stories I've ever read. Maybe that's an exaggeration, but they were really, really good. And then this guy, J.C. Hallman, who wrote Be and Me, which about how his own literary life was informed by Nicholson Baker's life. And it's called Creative Criticism. I'm not quite a big fan of it, but it's interesting to hear him explain it. So in any event, Rebecca, as always, has done a great job lining people up all the way through the summer. And we'll probably have plenty more that will be broadcast during the coming year. And I'm just really looking forward to it because there's so many good books coming out now. And there's so much more cerebral stuff coming out, like this book. So I just enjoy getting the chance to read that kind of stuff. It makes a big difference in my life. And it makes a wonderful difference getting the opportunity to be able to talk to these people, learn a little bit more about where the book came from, some of the things maybe I interpreted one way that they meant another way. I love that because I'm entitled to. I'm the reader. I'm entitled to do whatever I want. And that's what's really cool about the show, and that's what's really cool about the fact that these people come and talk to me. So as always, thank you so much for listening. You can hear us here. You can hear us on iTunes, on YouTube, on our Facebook page, on our website. And so you just have to go, type in the Avid Reader in iTunes, which is the easiest, and then just type in either whatever you want. They're all listed there. You can just type in Book of Speculation or Erica Swiler, any of those things. So enough of that. Thanks so much, and we will be talking to you and to another great author next week here on the Avid Reader.